My background is not as a chef, but I come from more like an academic family, and I studied history and political science and media studies. And when I started working with food and dedicating my time to food, writing in newspapers and also writing something as low as cookbooks, it was looked upon with bafflement and despair, depending on who you ask. But I'm now seeing that you academics are following through and understanding that this is really an important part of our society, and that's what we're going to have. You are going to have a seminar on, and we're going to have a discussion on. And I want to put my perspective on it, and hopefully I will won't talk so long that we won't have time to talk about it and discuss it afterwards. And hopefully I will say something that you thoroughly disagree with, and we can quarrel a bit, because I think that that is also really an important thing from my perspective, working with food, with chefs. I'm saying that there's not enough discussion about food in the food scene. So I think that overall, you academics are not invested enough, interested enough in food, present company excluded. But in my field, there's not enough discussion about it, about the meaning of food. And I do think that we need to have these frank discussions where we can sometimes thoroughly, thoroughly disagree as well. So I came into it as a writer, as a journalist, and then I sort of ventured into a more practical part of it. I've always cooked a lot, and that has always been at the heart of what I do. So I'm not writing about food, I'm invested in food. And the last decade or so, I've opened a few restaurants. One that is just up the street here, St. Lars, a grill restaurant. And I've opened a couple of Italian restaurants in Björvika, in the sort of culture district near the opera house. And I feel that it's incredibly. I thought that in a way I'd take out what I know by opening a restaurant, but I do feel that that has also been an incredible learning process about what is it to think of food as something more than what you and I have for dinner. You have to put it in a system which can sometimes be very oppressive in a way. And that is also one of the things that everyone who's working with food procurement is experiencing every day. I also want to brag a bit about the fact that I'm also a traveler, because I do think that that has informed my perspective on food by seeing how food is appreciated in other cultures. The sense that being with a group of indigenous people in the Amazon or in the Kalahari, you do realize that there are some things that are so incredibly vastly different, and there are some things that are so universal, and is always so unpredictable what is and what isn't. That is also an incredible source of joy and curiosity, I think. And I've also dabbled a bit as a farmer in South Africa. I have a house on a large farm outside of Cape Town, where at one point we established an agricultural project where our bragging rights were that at one point we harvested more than 124 different types of tomatoes. But the main point of that was to see the diversity, and I do think that I learned a lot from that as well. But I think the main focus of what I'm going to talk about today is some of the experiences that we have through Geitmyra Culinary Center for Children, which is a nonprofit foundation that I helped establish, and we opened 12 years ago in Oslo, in a dilapidated historical farm in the middle of Oslo between East and West. And what we do there is educational programs. So school children come to the center, and they get part of their education their school curriculum is sort of delivered by us. And that is, I think, a good model because we have a subject that everyone is supposed to study, which is called food and health, which was previously like food, home economics, the subject only for women. And then it became it became universal, but and it has been redefined the last couple of decades, but it hasn't been followed through with proper resources. So in most schools, less than 30% have formal training in the subject. But more importantly, I think those who care about it feel that their subject is not important to anyone else. And what does that do to the way you value the job you do? You feel self-esteem, and are you then going to fight for excellence? Not everyone has the strength to do that, although many teachers do. And I think that this model has been quite important also nationally. We've worked a lot with politicians and creating awareness, and we have also opened new centers. So in Ringsaker, one of the leading agricultural municipalities in Norway, we saw that most children in the biggest agricultural municipality did not grow up on a farm. You know, there are 530 working farms in Ringsaker. That is quite a lot. But still, most children do not grow up on a farm. If you grow up next to a farm, you may know nothing about food production. And in this municipality, the general sort of educational level fairly low. And the most important industry is food and food-related industries. And then the question is, who's going to be the next farmer? Who's going to be the next innovator within the food industry? That's obviously going to be someone who is really passionate about food. It's not necessarily going to be the one who grew up on a farm, or the one who had a father who was a butcher, or a mother who was a cook. So they have actually taken this step to inject more knowledge into their system to look after their next generation, and also, in a way, to fulfill the obligations that they are obliged to fulfill because it's part of the curriculum. We've also opened in Kristiansand, in the southern tip of Norway, where we are situated in Odderøya, the former military area. And we took over an administrative building, which was the most boring building on the island. I no longer think it is. As you can see, quite a lot of seafood. That is, so one of the things that we really want to do is to have a specialty in every center so they're not clones. So in Ringsaker, obviously a lot of agriculture, in Kristiansand by the sea, a lot of seafood. This weekend, we opened a new center in Norway's oldest city, Tønsberg, which is also a great vegetable producing area, but it's also an area with rich history. So we are going to focus a lot on food and history. So kids will spend a week at the center, but they will go through 10,000 years of food history. So what did the first people who came to the area eat, and what has subsequent generation eaten, and how has that helped shape who we are today? And I think that for us as a center that is growing, that will also sort of inject a lot of energy and knowledge into our entire system and new perspectives on what we're doing. So let me tell you about one day at the Eitmyra Culinary Center, because we try to take a more holistic perspective to food. The kids partake in growing vegetables, in weeding and looking after plants and vegetables, and they take great joy in sort of digging in the ground. And the fact that when you're digging next to some oregano plants, you get a really strong sensory experience just by doing something which apparently is not particularly food oriented, where you really understand that you're working with food because you can smell, you can experience things. And of course, very important to experience the joy of harvesting. And I think that, you know, sometimes there can be these sort of exaggerations that kids don't know that a carrot is grows in the ground. I think most kids know, but then again, I don't think most people know, because you can know it sort of theoretically. You know that, you know that people abroad are sometimes really poor, but you haven't really experienced it until you've met someone, interacted with someone who's from another place, or you've gone there. And the same thing is when it comes to pulling a carrot out of the ground. I think that, you know, neuroscientists talk about synapses in the brain. I think that it opens the synapses. So we have no aim of self-sufficiency at the center, but we want to have that sort of explosion of understanding, which comes from pulling that one carrot up from the ground. And also to learn that a carrot is not a product. Did you guys know that the carrot is originally from Afghanistan? So, you know, most people associate Afghanistan with not something sweet and crunchy and wonderful, that, and that's a good thing, you know, to associate Afghanistan with something other than war and trouble. And but it's also interesting that the carrot was originally purple, not orangey. That is something that we have done later on in the subsequent 2,000 years. I think that that is pretty interesting, and that is certainly interesting for children who love things that has to do with the nature, and they love to watch documentaries on dinosaurs. So you can use that same curiosity when it comes to a carrot. We've got multiple non-human teachers as well. So we have chickens, and that's also a part of, so they have a learning, the kids have a learning experience even between classes. When they interact with the chickens, they can collect eggs, and then we also want that when we use fish, for instance, we try not to view the fish as a product, but we're looking at a safe, you know, how did that fish live? Where is it from? What does it look like inside? And it's incredibly interesting to look at the gills, and then the kids will ask further questions. And how big is the brain of a safe? How many people know that here? I mean, I didn't know, but now I know. You know, how does the safe have an ear? Well, not our kind of ear, but it actually has the same sort of little bone inside for balance. And then, of course, they're also allowed to cook, and that's a really important part of what we do. We do not cook for the kids. The kids cook. You know, their abilities, their curiosities, their preferences help shape the food that we eat. And that is also incredibly empowering. And not least, it also sort of creates, we think, a social setting that is more conducive for deep learning. And the food is delicious. They like it. When we started, we knew that, you know, in order to be taken seriously by the public, and by the public sector and by the government, we have to prove that the food we eat and the food we serve and cook is healthy. But the food has to be delicious. That is the most important thing, because you can walk around and say, this is really, really important. But if what you're saying is really, really boring, then no one will pay attention. You can say that this food is really, really healthy, but if you don't like it, you will nod, and then that's it, you know. Yes, you know. And then you can repeat it if you're asked, is this going to be on the test? Yeah. Okay, then you'll s tell. But if you really like it, if you really enjoy it, if it's a part of a really special social setting, then we believe that that it has a much, much larger impact. Isn't this kind of fantastic? So, but if you think of these kind of things, it's, does your heart jump? I mean, this is like the boring part of food. Like, it has to be, but it can be incredibly, incredibly boring. But I think that we need always, when we work with food, you, we have all different backgrounds, some of you from law, some of you from nutrition, some of you from administration. But we have to snap back and think, what is food? Food is something incredibly special. It's something that we put into our bodies. We need it, otherwise we die. But we also use it as a cultural expression, carrier of history and heritage. And it's something that we enjoy. In the company of ourselves, in company of others, this is how we form social relationships. And the food that we eat is the production of labor, but in a very different way than other products. You know, your cell phone's fairly easy. You know, as a designer in California, assembly person in Asia, child in the mine somewhere in Africa. You know, it's not an easy story that either, but it's fairly important, fairly easy. But food is the result of the physical labor of the farmers, but also the labor of the land, of the soil. It's the labor of the sun and the rain, and the plants drink the water, and then there are millions and trillions and fantasillions of microorganisms in the earth that help in the food production. And the trees and the grass, everything, you know, be it the plants that surround us, what we eat, the animals that we live, they live off something. And the cooks and the chefs who make the ingredients into food, either at home or in institutions, and even the labor, the more administrative and intellectual work of guys like you, is a part of the system. And sometimes you can see the food around you, like we do in Ringstaker and Tønsberg, or in Kristiansand, where you can see the fishing boats coming into Reinertsen with the fish. But even in Oslo, there is this connection. This is where the market is, which has a profound effect. And also, of course, we've got food culture here in a different and sometimes stronger way, with the incredible food markets and restaurants and cafes. The food we eat is the result of the labor of the entire community, because the farmer is also connected to the rest of the society, and his kids go to school, and we need the roads. So sometimes we, when we just say the word food system, we do it as a blind, uninterested thing, as a fact, but it's actually a deep, deep thing that we can talk about in its, you know, in its infinite complexity, taking us to the farmers in Canada or Kazakhstan who make the bread, or to the ham that we had for our breakfast sandwich, which is made from a pig that ate soy that grew in Brazil, you know, and think about the rainforest there. So the point is that we need to have this understanding of the food system at the top of our minds, not at the back of our minds, when we talk about what food is. But when we talk about and we discuss food systems at Geitmyra, we don't say the word food system. We talk about it. We talk about it, and we let the kids use their curiosity. And I think that that is something that when I've worked professionally with adults and chefs and other food professionals for a long time, I see that they do not ask these questions. And that is a big fundamental problem. What do we eat? We eat plants, we eat animals, we eat fishes and other sea creatures, and we eat things that are made out of these basically three broad categories. And so we ask, where is it from? You know, what kind of, what are we eating? Is it a plant? Is it an animal? Is it a fish or another sea creature? What is it? How did that plant or fish or animal live? Where is it from? How did it get here? Those are the kind of questions that I think that an 11-year-old is pretty good at asking. Why shouldn't we? You know, we've got the tools to ask these questions. And I haven't. And of course, it ends up in deliciousness in something that affects them. And that's why they think that these questions are important to them. You know, a kid can really love things that aren't immediately important to them as well, but it becomes more important when you have something invested in it. And I haven't really lost the track of the subject. I'm trying just to circle it. The problem is that public sector food is often bad. It's often not particularly healthy, often not sustainable, or doesn't have any reflection on sustainability, is also often very boring, you know. And why is that important? Okay, imagine if you're in prison, you don't have any say in what you eat or what you do. So basically, the government feeds you, right? You're fed 3-4 times a day. So in your life, it's incredibly important. What does the government feed you? You know, is it good? Is it interesting to me? You know, but think of all the other people who are imprisoned by the government. Think of the children. If you go to kindergarten, you're in prison. You know, you never asked to go there. You know, your parents sent you there when you were 1 year old and you cried. And then they said, it's going to be better tomorrow and better the day after tomorrow. But you are there. Most of the day, you are in prison. You know, we don't have proper school lunches in Norway, but most kids from first to fifth grade go to after school programs where they are fed. They did not choose to go there. They are in prison. So we have a special obligation to serve them something that nurtures them, that is good for them. And then if you're a student, you do theoretically have a choice between the school cantina and something else. But in this economy, maybe not so much. And then, of course, you have the cantina at work where convenience and choice sort of intersect, and where it might be seen as sort of socially very strange not to go and eat in this. But you have a little bit more of a choice. And of course, then the hospitals and the old people's homes and stuff like that, and everyone has a story about someone they knew who has been to the hospital. My mother just had she's getting old. She had a minor fall, and she broke a finger, and then she had an operation, and then she had an infection because of that. You know, hospital infection. And then she had to go back to the hospital a couple of times. She lost about 10 kilos in the process. And for a 79-year-old woman who's really, really healthy, losing 10 kilos and being in that is a big setback. Then she's suddenly an old woman, not a sort of really healthy in her 70s. She was sort of looking into the next decade. And then researching this before our talk, I had a look at what does the hospital food sector say themselves. This is from their own brochure. It makes you want to, yeah. Well, this is how food very often is being seen. I don't know if it's controversial. It's my opinion that Oslo University Hospital could benefit from a little more focus on deliciousness. Do you think so? Controversial thing. The thing is, does public sector food, does it have to be bad? And I think there is sometimes, I mean, I'm furious all the time, you know? I'm furious all the time. I think that the world is mad. I mean, coming here on a seminar, sorry to be impolite towards the hosts, but coming here, seminar about food, I'm going to talk about deliciousness. And what is this? It's supposed to be a watermelon. Is this a watermelon? I don't know. Is it? Is a watermelon in the, you know, in a theoretical sense? I think that we can look at other parts of the public sector and look, you know, every time I talk to politicians about food and children, they'll say, no, but it kind of, it's super difficult. It has to kind of be that way. And about 10 years ago, our Minister of Education was trying to introduce school lunches in Norway. And I told her, it's just incredibly important that there is learning in this, that it's a part of a food of a food system that also encourages knowledge. So it's not instead of knowledge. And it's the most important thing is that, that car that delivers foods to the hospital and to the old people's home doesn't just make one more stop at the school. She said, ah, well, that's probably going to be the good logistic solution to this. But if you consider other parts of the public sector, this is a photo from, all Norwegians will recognize it, is from Bjørvika, where you have the public library. Oslo Public Library was named the best public library in the world. It's a knowledge institution. If you have a question about books, if you want really good literature, you go there. If you have a question, you ask the librarians. It is a fantastic place. And then you've got the Opera House next to it. Award-winning architecture, but that's not the most important thing. It is, that is the best expression of music and ballet that you will find anywhere in Norway, and world class. And in Norway, we have a public television media empire, which is NRK, publicly funded. And it is arguably the most important media institution. And that's where you get the deep news and the weekend entertainment. And that's public, and it can be done. And you've got knowledge institutions and universities. And if you want to ask an expert, you go there. If you want to, if you want to learn, if you want to study, you go there. And I once heard this sort of sketch where an actor said, "Well, you know, Hamlet is only 3,478 words, but King Lear is 13,297 words. So that's obviously a much more difficult role." But he said, the most important thing about acting is not just to remember all these words, you have to put them in the right order. And that is funny because obviously everyone knows that that is not acting. You know, remembering the words and putting them in the right order is not acting. The words on the page is not a book to be placed in that library. It's not knowledge to be communicated at the broadcaster or at the university. And this, one might argue, is not a watermelon. But how come in this kind of food in the public sector, we accept that as a watermelon? You would not accept that as if that was a book. We wouldn't accept it as a book. So I'm furious most of the time, I say. So the question is it possible? And I've already given you some examples about Geitmyra, which is one place where we at least are in very close contact with the public, and we want to show that we can have excellence, we believe, at the that is as good for the children as the learning you can get if you're a master's student by going to OsloMet, or even better. It's as good as the music you can get if you go to the National Opera and Ballet for these kids. And we also have programs where junior chefs, kids from 13 years old, get their first job, and they are trained by us, and they get a salary, and then they get a job, for instance, in the municipality making food at the local sports club or at the local community center. So that is a way of changing that food system with a focus on understanding and contact with the entire food system. But I also want to give you an example which is not public, but I think that it was something, a project I worked on about 10 years ago for Hurtigruten. Those of you who are not Norwegian might not know, it's the old postal system, ships going up and down the coast. Originally, it was literally the mail was delivered that way. Today, it's a cruise ship, so it has 13 ships, and in a way, it's arguably Norway's biggest restaurant because they serve more than 300,000 meals every year. And they had a problem that people came to look at the came from all over the world to look at this incredible nature that we had, but the food on the plate was completely irrelevant. So you would go into the Hardanger Fjord and look at the fjord and see those little farms that are sort of clutching to the hillside, and you would eat chicken breast with the cream sauce, you know. And we our challenge then was to make the food more relevant. And we developed something called Norway's Coastal Kitchen. And one of the things that we did when it came to procurement was we wanted to say, who can express something that is relevant for the story that we want to tell? So we collaborated not just with the big actors, which we did, you know. There was there was salmon and pork on the menu, and there was but Judith was a woman who was gathering wild herbs and making condiments. So we made an alliance with her, and started to buy her products and put them on the menu and displaying them. And I think that that was had a potential for change in the community where she came from, but it was a fantastic way to express the local identity of some of the places that we went to. And so when you were in Bergen, you had Bergen fish soup, which most Norwegians really don't know because they think it's just a creamed fish soup, but it's actually a sweet and sour taste fish soup made with saithe and this sort of small fluffy fish balls. And when you came to Ålesund, you had bacalao, so a strangely Mediterranean or Southern European part of Norwegian heritage, because the dried stockfish was traded out of Ålesund and Kristiansund. And we collaborated with small dairy farms. And at the end of the time when I worked on the project, we had collaborations with more than 40 small local producers, in addition to collaborations with some of the bigger actors. And we said we used relevance, cultural relevance, as a criteria when we made these alliances. So we had Arctic Char coming aboard at 3 a.m. at night and encourage people, those the insomniacs, to go down and watch them being loaded into the boat, and they were part of the meal that same evening, you know. And that is important to people, and it's a model I think that can aspects of that model can be used. And I've also worked on the food program in the municipality of Ringsaker that I talked about earlier, which was at that time Norway's biggest agricultural municipality. And they, as I said, they knew that they had to use food as a part of their strategy to grow and to keep the prosperity they had and to ensure later generations. And what they did was they said, well, food is going to be a part of every cultural arena that we are on. So every time there is a concert, there is going to be a food element to it, and that is not just serving something. So they arranged specific food festivals, but also put food as a part of the program on other things that didn't have anything to do with food originally. And of course, they opened the culinary center for children, which I'm very happy about. But it was also important that this was not just the special occasions. It was also taken into the programs for, they had a central kitchen producing food for hospitals and for disabled people and people who were not able to cook for themselves at home. And that food, I must admit, is was not, you know, terribly exciting. But one of the things that made it a little more exciting was a program to buy local food from small producers and serve it with a story, but also they would serve it. They would also collaborate with Nortura, which is like the big meat producer, in order to get a regular piece of pork from a farm in the municipality, so that they would say, today it's from Fjellgård. There is actually a Fjellgård there. And someone would remember that, you know, I was there when I was a kid, and that was also important part of it. So they made sure that food was a part of the program from the youngest kids to the oldest and most infirm. And I think that that was one of the things that made it into a very special program, and something that can be a good example for public food in other places in the country. So the thing is, food, I think, cannot be sustainable without being delicious, cannot be healthy without being nurturing, cannot be nurturing without being delicious, and cannot be delicious without taking care of the food system. Thank you. That was all I had.